This is the University of Virginia podcast. You're about to hear author and journalist Tom Wolfe address the class of 2006 at valedictory exercises.
Today, I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our keynote speaker, Mr. Tom Wolfe. A native Virginian, Mr. Wolfe grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and is a graduate of Washington and Lee University. He went on to get his PhD in American Studies from Yale University in 1957. Shortly after graduate school, Mr. Wolfe began his very distinguished career as a journalist writing for The Washington Post and The Herald Times Review, among others. Mr. Wolfe has amassed numerous literary achievements over the course of his illustrious career. He is credited with establishing a movement called New Journalism, which experimented with a variety of innovative literary techniques. During his career, Mr. Wolfe has published several journalistic works in this style, including The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Baby and The New Journalism. Constantly innovating and working to expand his repertoire, Mr. Wolfe turned to fiction with his first novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, in 1987, which was later turned into a movie starring Tom Hanks, Melanie Griffith, and Bruce Willis. Mr. Wolfe's next novel, A Man in Full, was published in 1998 to widespread acclaim and boasts the honor of staying on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 10 weeks. Published in 2004, Mr. Wolfe's latest book, I Am Charlotte Simmons, centers on the character Charlotte Simmons, a sheltered college freshman at the fictional DuPont University. The novel gives an account of the modern college experience and has been praised by critics and college students alike for its accuracy and attention to detail. The rights to this bestseller have recently been sold to the production companies Trilogy Entertainment and Syntax Entertainment, which are now developing a movie based on the book. Mr. Wolfe lives in New York City with his wife Sheila, daughter Alexandra, and son Tommy. Please join me in welcoming distinguished journalist and author, Mr. Tom Wolfe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Diana and Brooke and Jordan and the entire student trustee organization, and for that matter, the entire class of 2006. This, to me, is just a profound honor. You can't see what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking right at the rotunda. I'm in the arms of the academical village. It really doesn't get much better than this. But, of course, I want to give my special congratulations to the graduates of 2006 and to your parents. I've been in this role myself, and I know that you're justly proud of that your sons and daughters are graduating from one of the most historic universities in the United States. The most beautiful, with the very possible exception of Washington and Lee. And it's just, it's a charmed place. I don't know why Homer has his back turned towards me, but you can't have everything. And I think that the mothers and fathers who are here today should, in addition to the tremendous pride that you deservedly feel, you probably feel a kind of rogue wavelet of emotion that's going through your central nervous system right now. And you should ride that wavelet, go with it, because you'll figure it out later. What it is the realization that never again will you have to pay a parking ticket from the University of Virginia campus. My daughter, Alexandra, whom Diana was kind enough to mention a moment ago, I graduated from Duke in the year 2002, and I was standing around with a group of parents after the ceremony, and I said, you know, Alexandra's had four fabulous years here at Duke, but my God, you know, I've paid half of the entire revenue of the campus police parking ticket operation. Immediately, 5 other people raised their hands and said, I paid the other half. But if that's the worst of our problems, we're in good shape. This day is absolutely perfect in many ways, but perfect for the homily that I'm about to give you. I forgot to give a special nod also to, you know, there are 2,000 graduate students receiving advanced degrees tomorrow. Now, I feel very kin to them. When I was at the Yale Graduate School, I felt like a spectral ghost in the midst of this vibrant undergraduate life. In the fall, in the afternoons, we'd see all of these undergraduates piling these wicker baskets full of VNs into their station wagons. A station wagon is what they call a crossover vehicle today. And not to mention cases of beer. And to go off on the tailgating. That evening, we graduate students would hear the music of the hired bands in the fraternity houses. Great laughter. And then that marvelous kind of glockenspiel ping of empty beer cans hitting pavement off in the distance. We had no sports teams to root for. We had no bands. We never hired bands. For that matter, we never had parties. What you do is you, as a graduate student, you head off to this great Gothic library, to your cubicle, which is up in the stacks of a... And I tell you, the stacks of a Gothic library are about as gloomy as life gets. They're lit by these little circular, 22-watt circular bulbs known as the fluorescent bulbs. They're called the landlord's halo. And there I'd be, be a day like this. It's high spring. And each cubicle had a leper's window. They call that in Gothic architecture. It's they're very narrow, and the walls are so thick you can't get your head out to see what's outside. So I would, a day like this, I'd be looking at this rectangle of pure blue sky. Across it would be a shoot from a tree that I couldn't see, a green shoot. And there on the end of it would be a bud just bursting. And I would realize that out there in the world, there were all these mares giving birth to foals that came practically prancing out of the womb. There were rattlesnake eggs that were cracking open, and millions of little rattlesnakes were going through South Georgia like this. Azaleas, jonquils, blue tourmalines. I'm not sure about the blue tourmalines. Were bursting into, would be bursting into bud. And there I'd be in my cubicle doing a paper on Hemingway's use of the figure conjunctio in the dulling of the relative adverb in one sentence paragraphs. I mean, it was worth doing, but I don't remember exactly why. But anyway, I feel very much. Kin to you, and I'll tell you that all of the graduates of 2006, graduate students, undergraduates alike, were born at the right time, and I'm not kidding. This day of spring bursting is a perfect day for me to tell you about the amazing... And I probably speakers say this every year, but this is really true. The amazing opportunities that you have because you're graduating in the year 2006. If you have ambition, if you have imagination, if you're willing to take a risk, this century is for you. And now there's no reason why it should be true, but for the last 3 centuries, I'm now talking about the 19th, 20th, and this one. Right at the turn of the century, convulsive changes have taken place in the world. In the late 1700s, early 1800s, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the world was never the same again. The whole tradition of patriarchy and nobility and rule by lineage was swept aside. It was at that point that Thomas Jefferson, the White House was under construction. He made it a policy that all the tables in the dining rooms at the White House would be round, so that never again would there be a head of the table. The revolutions and this sweeping away of the traditions of old class lines was an amazing change. Now, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, we had Marxism, Freudianism, and modernism, all of which had extraordinary results. In the case of Marx, I don't even have to hear. He was a very unpleasant little man sitting in the British Museum writing this book called Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto. He kept the world convulsing up until 1989. It's still twitching in North Korea and a few other places. And Freud, I love the figure of Freud. Freud said, your beautiful ideals, all these things you believe in and credit yourself with, that's just parlor furniture. That's just your parlor furniture. Come with me. I'm going to take you down in the cellar and show you how this house really works. And he said, you see that boiler over there? That's you and your sexual energy. And if you do not let that out in a regular, controlled fashion, it's Powder Valley for you and your whole gang. It's all going to blow. Just think of how that particular vision has radiated through the world ever since then. I mean, he introduced today's, not at University of Virginia, but today's college era of our eyes met, our lips met, our bodies met, and then we were introduced. This one man with his ideas. Now, modernism in the arts, modernism in architecture, modernism in literature, you wouldn't think that would have such a profound effect, but it has. For one thing, you'll never again have architecture this beautiful. I'm sorry, folks. It's just not going to happen. There was always a cynical edge to everything that was done, and it carried straight through the 20th century. In painting, young students are in the art schools today, probably even as I speak, are in the cafeterias banging their Diet Pepsi cans on the tables, demanding instruction in line, form, color theory, perspective, the third dimension, all the things that are necessary for portraying people or objects. Unfortunately, the faculties, not true here, but the faculties were trained in the 20th century. They have no idea what these things are. While the young students are saying, by the year 2020, they'll be laughing at Picasso in precisely the way that when modernism came in at the beginning of the 20th century, they laughed at Bouguereau and Meissonier and Jerome, who had all these cupids flying through the flowers and around people's heads in historical paintings. They want line for the eight best-selling young American painters in auction. These are objective terms. Are all painting people and objects. Now, they don't always look like the people and objects you're familiar with. I mean, there's one much acclaimed painting now called Woman Eating Her Chin. But it's representational. It's you have to be there, but it's but it's a person. It's recognizably a person. Things are just changing. Are changing so rapidly. Architecture is a field I love. An amazing thing was done in the early 20th century. It's just it almost cracks me up. Just to blow away. Architects in a movement known as modernism, remember that? Modern architecture? They decided to, if they were right-handed, to tie their right arm behind their backs and to tie their left elbow behind their back. This leaves you with a flipper. So that about all you can manage is a straight edge and a straight line. And you're lucky if you can design an erector set with slabs of glass to paste on it. And so that's all we've had for just about 100 years. Now, there are now architecture students all over America who are beginning to yammer and bang their dyed Pepsi cans on the table saying, there's got to be a way out of this. There must have to be a way out. Well, there is, and it's being shown by architects such as Frank Gehry, Santiago Calatrava, who have introduced marvelous Baroque, even mannerist curves, sumptuous, luxurious curves, which in addition to providing the look of conspicuous consumption, also have just broken this the stranglehold of flipper architecture. Or Robert A.M. Stern, a great American visionary architect who suddenly said, hey, you know what? It's possible to use every form. Guess what? You can use every form. And I think the University of Virginia is really fortunate to have Stern's architecture, and I'm sure the architecture faculty is behind him in the great work that he's done. Now, and these are actually small changes in this. These are small changes. We're talking about arts and architecture. The big change, of course, was... let me preface it by saying in 1992, 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, a scholar, political scientist named Francis Fukuyama wrote a book entitled The End of History. And his premise was that humankind have finally arrived at the one utopian form of political government, liberal democracy. For this, he was hailed as a prophet, as a major American philosopher, the end of history. And people looked at Francis Fukuyama, a visionary. He could see the future. Unfortunately, 9 years later, a fairly small group of Arabs cranked history back up again. And suddenly, a huge convulsion took place, and we're living in that convulsion now. Poor Fukuyama is not a fool, but he looked like a fool immediately. It hasn't held him back, though. I shouldn't say that. He's actually a wonderful thinker. But anyway, one of the things we then began to notice, why didn't we notice it sooner? I didn't notice it, is suddenly how many Muslims are in Europe. And it suddenly becomes obvious that by the year, well, certainly 2056, let's say, a voting majority of Frenchmen, of Dutchmen, will be Muslim. There's not going to have to be any Al-Qaeda in the picture. They will have, by parliamentary means. Why is this? This is because it may be great, but the native stock, the birth rate of the native stock in European countries has dropped off a cliff. To sustain your population, you need 2.1 births per woman of childbearing age. The 0.1 is allowing for infant deaths and so on. That's just to keep your population going at its present numbers. In Spain today, it's 1.2. It's just the birth rate is 1.2, just half enough to to keep your population up. In Germany, it's about 1.4 now. Surprisingly, France is, you wouldn't think this, but France is higher. It's about 1.8. Getting out of Europe for just a second, Japan is about 1.1. They were having to import Filipino women just to try to keep up. And, you know, they despise every... but they are importing... and in this country, the rate is much better than most places, but in no small part because of immigrants. We're at 1.9, but if you discount immigrants, we fall down to about 1.5. Now, these are not... what this means is there are whole populations that are shrinking, and, you know, devolution of population is just as rapid as the overpopulation that everybody was fearing about 25 years ago. Now, why did this happen? Why has this happened? I submit it's because of the erosion of religion in Europe and in the United States. One of the main functions of religion is to herd everybody into a monogamous situation and to set up penalties for not being monogamous. Everybody knows that there are going to be people who climb over that wall at night, but at least they have to climb the wall. Today, there's the gates are wide open. There's an arrow saying, this way. And the man who had one of the biggest influences on our history was Charles Darwin, who said, far from being the children of God, whom he made in his own image, you're beasts, like the beasts of the field. Face it. Live with it. And this became a very convincing theory. And today they speak of Europe. I had always thought of it as being were Catholic nations. Officially they still are. But in fact, they are now termed by all political scientists as secular nations. The United States, not that much, but among educated, well-to-do people, that idea of that God is immanent in your being, it's considered a bit uncouth, although there are many, many millions of people who disagree. But human beings cannot live without an explanation. I think probably when man got language, the first question he asks is the one that three-year-olds ask. Why? Why? Why am I here? How did I get here? What is this struggle called life all about? There must be a reason. There must be an explanation. But we don't demand hope. We demand a convincing explanation. And Darwin's explanation was convincing. Just think. Jesus. Well, I'm going to just mention some people who sheerly through their words. They were not backed by any organization. They were not backed by money. They were not backed by politicians. Just sheerly through their words, offering explanations of what human life was all about, had amazing influences on our history from 1 A.D. to the present. First of all, Jesus. Jesus offered hope. A lot of hope. The meek shall inherit the earth, and the last shall be first. John Calvin offered less hope. Muhammad offered more and less hope. Marx offered much more hope. Incidentally, Marx was much influenced by Jesus. This is not generally known. He offered the meek shall inherit the earth next week after the revolution. Freud offered more sex. Darwin offered nothing whatsoever. And Darwin's heritage is now being reinforced by the group that have created the hottest intellectual movement in the universities today. I'm talking about neuroscience. The neuroscientists are super Darwinians. And if you talk to some of the younger neuroscientists, you'll get the straight story of what they really mean. The older ones are, you know, they're a little political about it, but they know how to curve a straight line. But their feeling is that due to genetic, everything that we do, including anything we do in the next 5 minutes, is controlled by our genetic makeup and evolution as described by Darwin. They feel that, in fact, we are computers that walk. And our software is such that if you know the software, you can predict what a human being is going to do from moment to moment. You could predict that a speaker is going to suddenly, in 5 seconds, is going to strike his forehead. You can see it coming. And they believe that there is no such thing as free will. No such thing whatsoever. Their favorite simile is that suppose you threw a rock, and while that rock was in mid-flight, you gave it consciousness. And they say that rock would give you a million rational reasons why he was going in this particular direction, and would have airtight arguments as to why he shouldn't go in any other direction. And they say all you are is a rock in mid-flight that suddenly had consciousness. Now, this is bleak beyond belief. When I ask them, how come you know all this and I don't, and you're telling me? And I said, genetics. I kind of like it. I was raised a Presbyterian. It's really like predestination. Not bad stuff at all. Now, this is why I think there is... one of the recent neuroscientific studies was on why it is that so many beautiful young women marry rich, ugly old men. And the explanation is it's a genetic impulse. They know that a rich or powerful man, no matter how ugly he might be, is the one who can carry the gene pool forward. You know, it takes 13 years to raise a human being to maturity. Well, this ugly old guy can make he's more sure of getting your offspring through all of this than any other type of person. And if this young woman is caught in an awkward place or position, her excuse always is, hey, honey, don't blame me. I'm just a lifeguard in the gene pool, you know. But we are, and this is why I think your class, and it was true also of last year's class and perhaps next year's, is such a prime position. We're in a convulsive state in terms of the political look of the world, in terms of man's explanation for his own existence. It's such a perfect time to make a huge difference in a confused and, I would say, chaotic universe. For one thing, there is a new theory, which I rather subscribe to myself, that evolution actually ended 11,000 years ago, as soon as mankind invented speech. And with speech, no longer did the human being need to evolve. You know, we really don't need to develop a couple of flippers on our backs in case we end up in the water. It takes care, it ends human evolution. Also, it has ended animal evolution. It's reached the point where we can eliminate any animal we can see. We could eliminate it by the end of next week if we felt like doing it. That's why we're now very sentimental about predators. The lions, the tigers, the wolves, the grizzly bears. It's a luxury you have. You can be sentimental about these things. But if that theory is correct, that evolution is a footnote to human history. Artificial selection is everything. Now, everything important in life is man-made. Evolution means absolutely nothing. And evolution has as much to do with human nature today as the Bessemer process of adding carbons to pig iron has to do with the nature of the skyscraper. It's true you wouldn't have a skyscraper without the smelted metal, but it does not describe the nature of the structure. Today, we are wide open for the words of a prophet. Now just think, I've mentioned these single individuals with no backing. Jesus, Calvin, Muhammad, Marx, Freud, Darwin, and now the neuroscientists. If there's anyone amongst you who has an explanation of why, what are we here for? What is this struggle called life all about? And why shouldn't there be here at the University of Virginia, where so many great things began in this nation? Why shouldn't there be? And if you can hear my voice at this moment, do it. Do it. And you will light up the sky and be remembered by humanity with ultimate gratitude forever. It's been a great privilege to me to have a chance to speak to you, and I thank you so much for having me. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf, for your comments here today. When I first heard the term YEPI in a seminar this past semester, my mind immediately reverted to its three-year-old mode, as I thought of two characters from the greatest television show of our time, Sesame Street. I quickly realized that the seminar was not in fact referring to these fictional characters, actually named the Yip Yips, but rather to a group of real people. We, the members of the class of 2006, are YEPIs. We are young, experimenting perfection seekers, and we are still finding our way in the world. In describing our generation of perfection seekers, one anthropologist states, YEPIs are unsure how to achieve their ambitions, so they experiment through a shopping-style approach to life, trying to find the perfect job, the ideal relationship, and the most fulfilling lifestyle. In other words, we look at life like it's a huge all-you-can-eat buffet, feeling the need to sample everything and settle for nothing. There's no better place than UVA for the shopping-style approach to life. Creativity, flexibility, experimentation, perfection-seeking are just a few of the basic principles of this school. From study abroad programs around the world, to the hundreds of student organizations on grounds, to volunteering opportunities within the Charlottesville community, to classes ranging from structural engineering to art history. The university provided our class with the means to experience all aspects of life. We were free to take risks at UVA with little to no repercussions. We could take an accounting class even when our math skills were taxed just by calculating the tip during dinner on the corner. We could try out for club sports, no matter our skill level. We could take risks in our love lives, knowing that the usual worst-case scenario would be a few jokes by our friends at our expense. This leads us to the potential scary part of graduation. We may never again be in a place so conducive to the young, experimenting perfection seeker. What is important to remember, and why, as YEPIs, we must embrace the end of our time here, is that we may never again need a place so conducive to the young, experimenting perfection seeker. Our experiences at the university have prepared us for life beyond college. Many of us are graduating with jobs, but are they the jobs we will work at for the next 40 years? Many of us are graduating without jobs, but are we going to be unemployed for the next 40 years? Many of us are moving to cities we have never visited, or continents we have never stepped foot on. Are these the places we are going to live for the rest of our lives? I believe the answer to all these questions is no. I arrived at the university believing that after 4 years, I would have my life figured out. I mean, it seems so simple. Discover my academic passion by the second week of school, find a great girl by the third week, determine what I wanted career-wise by the fourth week, and walk onto the basketball team by the fifth. Okay, maybe not that last one, but the others seem possible. I believe that UVA would provide me with the answers to my questions concerning my place in the world. After 4 years in Charlottesville, though, I am left not with answers, but rather with possibilities. UVA did not provide me with a specific roadmap to my future. It instead instilled in me the necessary tools to draw my own. Our futures are not set in stone, and we have questions that are still unanswered. What we can take away from our university experience is the knowledge that when the time comes, we will have the ability to make the tough decisions, shaping our own lives. We have had 4 amazing years at this university, and it is time for this chapter in our lives to end. We have one final task to accomplish here at UVA, a little stroll tomorrow morning down the center of the lawn. Afterwards, with our degrees in hand, we'll be ready to tackle everything the world has to offer, which may be quite a bit, because we are a generation of yuppies, and we are striving for perfection.